subcommittee of the Subcommittee of Ways and Means for General Government for the purpose of taking public testimony on Senate Bill 5540, the Oregon Racing Commission. And here's our distinguished chair.
I'll
hand you back your gavel.
Thank you.
The sign-up sheet, and we have just opened.
Okay. And you do have a sign-up sheet?
Right there.
Thank you very much, Representative Johnson. Apologize for being late. Rob Douglas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rob Douglas, representing the Oregon Thoroughbred Breeders Association. Joan Buck and myself have had the pleasure, and it has been a pleasure, to represent those folks for 25 years. We are here today in support of the Racing Commission budget. We feel that in the 2.5 decades that we've been involved with racing, that this is the best racing commission that we've had a chance to work with. And I'll just give you a brief example of something that happened recently that bears that out. The longtime executive director of the Racing Commission, Steve Barham, moved on to Arizona. The Racing Commission conducted a search for a new executive director. In conjunction with the Department of Administrative Services, they did it efficiently, they attracted quality candidates, and they made a good choice for executive director. There was none of the back and forth that you hear about from other agencies between the commission and Department of Administrative Services. That went smoothly. When they got down to the finalists for executive director, they had folks who were affected by Racing Commission decisions come in, and they were all afforded a chance to talk to the candidates. We think this commission is headed in the proper direction, and we support their budget today.
Great. Questions for Mr. Douglas?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rob. And Alan Westfall, President of the Oregon Fairs Association. Welcome, Alan.
Good morning. Thank you. For the record, I'm Alan Westoff from Grants Pass, Chairman, President of the Oregon Fairs Association, members of the committee. Glad to be here. And we're here to speak on behalf positively for the budget for the Oregon Racing Commission. As you know, we have 5 racing fairs that are very, very important to our communities, very important to our fairs, and our relationship, and since I've been here and many years before that, with the Racing Commission, they've been very supportive of the county fairs, and without their help, we would not be here, and without the support of the Racing Commission in the past, and with the new director, Jody, our conversations, I think the Burnses and the Grants Pass, the Tillamooks and the Unions and Prineville's are in very good shape. So we've been here to recommend and we support it in its entirety.
Thank you very much, Alan. Questions for Mr. Westhoff? Thank you. Thank you very much, Alan. And Dave Nelson?
Mr. Chairman, can I be joined by my partner, Larry Campbell?
You bet. You bet.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson. I represent Magna Entertainment Corporation, who owns both Portland Meadows Racetrack and Multnomah Kennel Club. We're here to offer our support for the Oregon Racing Commission and the adoption of their budget. I think they do an outstanding job. They have done. I became involved in trying to raise a racehorse in the late 1960s, and whether we've been very successful or not, I sold my best one to Larry Campbell, and that was either a good fortune or ill fortune, but nonetheless, we've had a lot of fun with it through the years. Racing has been a good value for the state of Oregon. It provides an opportunity for about 3,000 people to have gainful employment. About $140 million in economic impact to the state of Oregon. We've done a couple of surveys through the Survey Research Center over the last 20 years at Oregon State University and have good agribusiness value for the state, relatively clean. We did have an environmental problem at Portland Meadows over the course of the last 7 or 8 years. We think that that's been well resolved now. Our client spent about $800,000 in developing their water quality improvement activity. Racing has been impacted through the last 20 years by state jurisdictions entering into the voluntary revenue or lottery business. If you look at page 2, you see I tried to do a summary of the growth of the video lottery, of lottery gaming, which then allowed the entry into the state of Indian casinos. And you see at the bottom of the page the dramatic growth of video gaming in the 1995-1997 period. If you turn over to the next page, you see that that resulted, or there was a corresponding reduction in wagering on racing during that same period of time of about $21 million. That amounted to a 17.5% revenue reduction for the racing industry in Oregon, which translates into about $4.2 million annually in revenue for operations, for purses for horsemen, and for purses for dog owners. That can be directly correlated with the growth of video lottery. Now that states are looking at shifting for more revenue from lottery activities by converting to slot machines or slot games, we look at another possible impact for racing in Oregon. Still, we're very optimistic, and it's the reason that Magna Entertainment has entered into ownership of the racetracks here in the state. And Larry, you want to talk about some of the activities that have gone on over the last several years?
Well, first of all, I want to suggest that if Magna had not come into the state, we would not have racing today. And one of the things that we are extremely pleased with the Racing Commission is the fact that they're providing support for our county racing, which is extremely important to the horsemen across the state of Oregon. We've made a number of attempts to assist racing from a financial standpoint because, as Dave says, both the video poker machine entree into the state and the Indian casinos in the state have taken a severe toll on the ability to keep racing an active participant in the state. And, for example, in 1995, the legislature passed House Bill 3411, which authorized us to increase the number of video poker machines from 5 to 75 machines. The legislature acted favorably upon that request in that bill, but unfortunately the governor didn't see it that way, and the bill was vetoed. The proceeds would have bolstered racing revenues with 30% operator share and state revenues with a state share. Then Governor Kitzhaber, after that, vetoed another bill. In fact, on three different occasions, the legislature responded to the needs of the racing community, but were unable to get the bill actually placed into law. We basically see the future of racing as extremely bright from the standpoint of the support that we're getting both from the commission and from the new owners at Portland Meadows, but we very surely see the need for additional revenues if we're going to basically bring live racing back to the point where it was a few years ago.
Thank you very much. Questions of either? Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many people are currently employed out at Portland Meadows?
Don't have the exact number, but the employment ranges both at Portland Meadows. I think they give out close to 1,000 1099s a year to people who are trainers, grooms, the veterinary staff that works on the backside, employees who work directly for Portland Meadows on the front side, as well as those who work on the backside. Most of the employment then scatters out through the state and the breeding farms and the training farms around the state, and then disperses from there, and the economic impact comes from the purchase of hay and oats and other services, tack shops, farrier services, and so on.
So you don't
shelves for your trophies if you're Mr. Kent?
Shelves for the trophies.
I built my own shelf. I have to enlarge it, of course.
So you don't know how many W-2s are actually given out for wage-earning employees?
I'll get that information.
Okay, thank you very much. Further questions of either Larry or Dave? Thank you very kindly. And Dave Benson?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm David R. Benson. I'm president of the Oregon Horsemen Benevolent and Protective Association. Our organization represents in excess of 1,700 owners and trainers racing thoroughbred horses in the state of Oregon at Portland Meadows, as well as our five county fair race meets. As you're well aware, pubs have located in Oregon over the past two, three, 4 years, primarily because of the favorable tax structure. These hubs have contributed great dollars to the state of Oregon and the general fund, as well as to the economic impact of our county fairs and the racing that's held there. We're here today, obviously, to support the Oregon Racing Commission, their handling and disbursement of the funds. Their rulemaking of these funds has been good for the industry as well as the state of Oregon, and we speak in favor of.
Thank you very much, Mr. Benson. Representative Johnson is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You made reference to favorable tax structure. Could you provide more detail about what you mean?
Well, years prior to hubs coming to Oregon, we had hubs located in Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York. Those states were charging 3-4% tax percent of the handle, of the dollars wagered through those hubs. Oregon's tax is 0.25%, 0.25% of the total wagered, and that was brought the hubs to Oregon because of that favorable structure that they would obviously make more money. Unfortunately, we have California that is now, we have hubs located in California who charges 0% interest going to the state. And so we have seen hubs also located in California. But that is only applies for the California residents who wager within California. We have five hubs now in Oregon. We expect to see hopefully a couple more in the near future, but the tax structure basically is lower than other states.
Follow up, Representative Johnson.
Thank you. When you say you hope to see others, how do the hubs make a decision about what community to locate in?
Communities or state? I'm sorry.
When you said you hope to see others in Oregon, I'm trying to understand what factors would be relevant in making a decision to pick town A over town B.
It's not so much town, it's the state itself.
Oh, I misunderstood you.
No, it could locate anywhere within the state of Oregon. The tax structure would be the same to the state. The city is not an issue. We have them in Beaverton, and we have them in Portland, and the east side and the west side, and the actual city where they locate is immaterial.
Dave, when they decide to locate in Oregon versus California, and California has a zero, whereas Oregon is 0.25% fee for the rake off of the hub. Does California have higher licensing fees, higher daily use fees than we have then?
No. What happened is the hubs located in Oregon initially, California account wagering was not legal within the state of California. To pass that law in California making account wagering legal, one of the requirements was that any operators accepting wagers on account wagering would have to locate in California. And to do so, they charged no tax to that hub operator.
You know how they operate, how they pay the overhead expenses on their operations in California? That they have a racing commission or some commission that must oversee it, I assume.
Oh, yes, they do. And
the general fund, do you know?
I'm sure that overseeing that is from general fund.
Okay. Further questions of Mr. Hobbs or Mr. Benson? Thank you very much, David. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to charge the folks from the racing commission. Yeah, there's Jody back there. I'm going to charge Jody to please give us some information about California. ASAP. I don't want those folks to eat our lunch. So with that, we're going to go ahead and close the hearing on Senate Bill 5540 on the Racing Commission, and then we will open the hearing on Senate Bill, House Bill 5001, Board of Accountancy. Mr. Wine will represent us from the Legislative Fiscal Office.
passing out the Cheerios.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Passing out the Cheerios, you say? No,
Cheerios.
Materials.
Oh, materials, okay.
I like Cheerios better.
Sounded like church. Kids with the Cheerios. Grandchildren occupied. Okay. Mr. Wine?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Board of Accountancy, as you know, is charged with the regulation and licensing of accountants, both public accountants and certified public accountants in the state. From its budget is, of all other funds, it's funded out of licensing fees of those regulated. There were no budget notes from the 2001 session. There were no special audit reports. It has only one budgetary program, and that's its regulatory program. Its current budget request provides for ongoing maintenance of board activities. And we have with us Carol Reeves and Mr. Jim Gaffney of the Board of Accountants.
Okay, thank you very much. Please come forward. And Satish, I think we'll vary just slightly from our normal presentation. And I'm going to have you fly down to from the 30,000-foot level and give us a quick overview of the governor's budget for the Board of Accountants, starting on page 2.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, Satish Upadhyay with the Department of Administrative Services. The governor's budget for the Board of Accountancy consists of $1,657,951 total funds. This is a 2.1% increase from the 2001-2003 legislatively approved budget through the fifth special session. The budget was not reduced during the numerous special sessions that we've had, and basically the budget continues existing operations. 53% of the budget is personal services and 47% is services and supplies. How the budget was developed, the starting point was the 01-03 legislatively adopted budget. This consists of $1,583,087 other funds. There were base budget adjustments for position actions and compensation changes of $113,113 other funds. And there are three essential packages. Package 010 provides standard inflationary increases for overtime and other payroll expenses, and it also provides adjustments for mass transit taxes. Package 020, it phases out a one-time computer upgrade expense that took place in 01-03. This is a reduction of $26,339 other funds. And package 030 provides standard inflationary and costs and state government service charges adjustments. It's an increase of $45,249 other funds. There's one policy package. It's a program reduction package. This reduces the agency's budget by $57,569 other funds based on their projected expenditures.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Upadhyay? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Package 030, the inflation and price list adjustment, the state government service charges. Do you have any detail on that breakdown?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I can provide you the specific breakdowns, but I have the number, and the number for the amount of increase, in fact, it was a decrease for the Board of Accountants. It was a decrease of $1,808. And I would be glad to provide you with the details, a comparison between 01, 03, and 03, 05.
Mr. Chair,
please.
The point that I'm getting at, Mr. Padgett, is I don't know, because I'm just not familiar with this budget, where the Board of Accountancy is housed and whether or not there have been additional charges for DAS services like maintenance, rent, and I might be completely fouled up here, and if you could help me. That's what I'm looking for.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, they are housed at a private building on Pringle Parkway, right? What's the building called?
Pringle Road.
And so it's not a DAS building. And this budget does provide a little bit of extra limitation for rent because it wasn't, they were not fully funded for rent in 01-03.
Then you've answered my question.
Thank you very much. Carol, let's go ahead and take it through as quickly as you can on your budget then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, I would like first to introduce to you Jim Gaffney, who's our Secretary Treasurer of the Board, a member of the Board of Accountancy, and he has a few remarks to begin.
Thank you. Jim, please.
Chair Butler, members of the Joint Committee, I am Jim Gaffney. I'm the managing partner for the Portland office of Moss Adams. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. The Board of Accountancy protects the public by regulating the practice and performance of all services provided by licensed accountants. therefore protect the public by licensing qualified public accountants and regulating the services they provide. The board also adopts minimum standards for the practice of public accounting, ensuring that new licensees meet entry-level standards of competence and that all licensees maintain professional competence. The Board of Accountancy is made up of one public member and six licensed professionals, each of whom is appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. The board provides license authority to certified public accountants, municipal auditors, and public accounting firms. The four basic areas that we perform include examination and licensing, continuing professional education, peer review oversight, and discipline and enforcement. These are four critical areas of what we do. The Board of Accountancy operates under a single program unit and has no programs or activities that are not specifically linked to its mission and goals. There are no off-site office locations, and all employees are supervised daily by our administrator. During the current biennium, we administered the uniform CPA exam for approximately 900 candidates. We saw a 4% increase in our license base from 8,009 licensees to 8,340. We upgraded the six-year-old computer system that we're on. We established a special task force to review the independent standard of Oregon licensees in the wake of the increased number of audit failures in public companies, together with new requirements imposed by the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation at the federal level. The task force will make recommendations to the board for revision of the independent standards and record retention requirements. We investigated 138 complaints during the biennium. 31 resulted in no violation. 60 resulted in orders imposed in a civil penalty. There was one suspension, one resignation, and 9 revocations. 58 of the 138 investigations conducted were settled through litigation, and 11 are still in the hearing process. We make use of technology primarily through the Internet. By adding this presence, we can offer application forms on the Internet. The database of our licensees can be queried. We can provide consumer education and awareness of what the accounting regulatory issues are for our profession. There are many changes at the national level for licensed certified public accountants and public accountants to follow professional standards that are accepted. Consequently, the Board of Accountancy must be aware of and respond to changes that affect the professional standards. Many of the changes are beneficial, while others may not be appropriate. The Board must weigh every change that affects the profession against the Board's mission to provide public protection and respond accordingly. Examples would be the CPA computerized exam, changes to record retention, pressure to adopt new continuing education requirements, that type of thing. I would like to mention two matters that affect our budget for the upcoming biennium. First, the implementation of the CPA exam, which is scheduled to take effect now, although it's been pushed back once. In April of 2004, it was previously scheduled to take effect in November of 2003, and it will reduce the direct expenditures previously associated with our administration of the written exam that we are still administering. Senate Bill 153 addresses this budget impact that will result from the implementation of this. It would change the current ORS 673.060, which authorizes the board to contract with any organization, governmental or private, to provide examination services. What Senate Bill 153 would change would be to allow the various testing services to collect directly from the candidate those fees associated with the services provided by the testing agent. The Board of Accountancy will continue to charge and collect an application fee from the candidate. The purpose of the bill is to prevent the board from becoming the collection agent and assuming responsibility for pass-through fees for services which the board has no authority over. It will prevent the situation that would cause the board's budget to be artificially inflated by pass-through funds and will prevent the board's resources from being expended for management and accounting for these pass-through funds. And then finally, there's Senate Bill 150, which addresses a technical issue that we have. It's the absence of the statutory authority to impose a late fee for public accounting firms that submit late registration renewal forms. This is something that's an oversight, and we think it will be corrected. Thank you for your attention this morning. And Carol Reeves, our administrator for the board, would have some comments after mine.
Certainly. Thank you very much, Jim. Are there questions for Mr. Gaffney? Jim, what's the status on Senate Bill 153 regarding the testing contracting for contested services?
Mr. Chair, it has passed both the House and the Senate.
Okay, so the governor signed?
Not yet.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
And the late fee, Senate Bill 150?
Same status.
Okay. Thank you very kindly. Carol?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Senator Winters.
Question, because it was mentioned about your number of hearings, and just wanted to know if your Attorney General fees have, using more or less of the Attorney General in your hearings.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I will defer to our administrator for that.
Thank you, Jan. Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I think our Attorney General fees have pretty well maintained a flat level over the last 2 to 3 years. We increased the Attorney General budget expenditure limitation in 1999, and we've remained fairly flat since then at the higher level. We do have a fairly large budget for Attorney General fees, Senator Winters.
How's your utilization of the hearing panel? Are most of your hearings going to the panel?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, of course we're required to use the hearing panel. All of our hearings go through that panel. We negotiate as many as we can prior to going to administrative hearing. We probably average in a biennium at most 5 that actually go to hearing. Otherwise, we issue a lot of notices and then negotiate settlements with those licensees or individuals.
And you're negotiating settlement rate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, generally what we will negotiate is the amount of the civil penalty. We all may also negotiate the discipline. For example, if revocation is a discipline that has been proposed, we may negotiate that to a period of suspension and a probationary period. If all terms are met, then the revocation will go away. If there's any violation of any of those terms, the revocation would automatically go into effect. So there will be a reduction of the originally proposed terms through settlement. Yes, Senator, that's true.
I guess what I'm getting at is, what is your rate of the number of actions that you take? You know, you said you had 5 that went to the panel. How many do you settle without going to the panel? What's the percentage? And you don't have to give that, but I'd like that information at some time. You can give it to us later.
I'd be glad to provide that for you, Senator.
On page 7 of 14, there are some statistics of the handouts today, but that does not get Representative or Senator Winters to what your questions were. I just need to ask a question while we're on Attorney General's fees. This isn't one of those boards that has one of the Attorney General staff just come and camp out with it, is it?
Mr. Chair, I wish we could afford that, but no.
Okay.
We do, however, invite our Attorney General to attend our board meetings, and she does attend all of the board meetings.
Is that necessary?
We feel that it is. She provides counsel throughout the meeting
as
to many decisions that the board may be making. We think that she keeps us out of trouble that way.
How often do you meet?
The board meets, Mr. Chair, approximately 6 times a year.
Okay. So every other month?
Approximately.
Okay. I just am concerned about, do you have attorneys on the board?
Golly, Mr. Chair, no. Oh, excuse me.
Okay.
Present company accepted here. But he's an acting CPA, so I forget.
I appreciate that, and I don't expect those attorneys that are on the board or maybe on the board that, and amongst the profession, I recognize there's some crossover. But my concern is that an attorney will normally be able to tell you if you're moving into an area where you need an attorney. And I feel very strongly that we've got attorneys that are running almost every board in this state. And I would appreciate it if we did not have the Attorney General staff come and camp out on these particular boards. I don't mind your folks saying we think that might have some legal implications as they're looking at the agenda, and then having someone come and let you know what that is or to respond subsequently to it. But I guess I'm very anxious when I see this moving up an additional for this particular time. I mean, we've gone from $67,000 to $77,000 to $87,000 for a biennium. I just don't see any end to it. And that's a concern that I've got. When you take the difference between 67 and 87 over the past 2 years, that's a very substantial increase. Representative Johnson's recognized.
Conversely, Mr. Chair, I feel compelled to share a conversation I had last night with a dual CPA attorney. It was a social conversation, and he's in the process of litigating with the Department of Revenue. And the observation that he made was, how much litigation could be forestalled if they actually had litigation review, I mean, legislation reviewed prior to offering it, had it reviewed by professionals practicing in the field, so that they're not trying to later sort out in courts exactly what the legislation meant.
And that probably isn't something that your Attorney General staff is going to do at your office during your board meetings either. So.
No, actually the recommendation was to have lay folks come in and take a look at proposed legislation, lay practitioners, prior to having it move forward into the legislative process.
Senator Winters?
The review process doesn't bother me on specific issues as what concerns me, and I have the same concern as the chair, where we do have with boards and commissions and also state agencies where there is not on a specific issue that the AG is involved in, but where they actually become a part of that board and there for every board meeting. When you talk about six meetings, and I don't know if your meetings are 2 hours, 3 hours, what the length of your meetings are, and I'm certain that probably sometime that they're there that they don't even need an opinion. And so that there's two concerns that I have is whether or not the AG's office is actually managing boards through this process and taking the management responsibilities away from those who are responsible for managing. I have that same concern as I deal with my agency that I'm responsible for, Human Services.
Representative Johnson, I think that would be like telling a farmer what he was going to plant next year. CPAs are just as independent as the farmers are. But I appreciate your concern because it is a concern that we all share relative to these kinds of boards. A word to the wise, I hope there would be that if you've got a three-hour board meeting six times a year, you've burned up a couple of $1,000 at that particular point in just the board meetings of AG's fees. So if we could make absolutely certain that those folks are utilized for what they're for. Jim?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm relatively new to the board. I've been on it for 2 years, and I do have a legal background. I've been very impressed with the efficiency with which we've been able to use our representatives from the AG's office. They do participate in every board meeting that we have, but often it's by phone, and usually it's only for the portions of our meeting.
Excellent.
We need the legal counsel.
And that would be a wise use of that time. Billing those folks that bill by the minute, like CPAs have to do, are cognizant of how much they're being charged for those kinds of things, and I appreciate that.
If I could offer what I think the increases are for is because there's also pressure on us, because we regulate our own, so to speak, that we're trying to be more vigilant in terms of looking for violations among our membership that adversely affect the public, and so we need most of the legal time that we have isn't for the board meeting time, but it's for the research and the handling of cases that we have, and as we become more active, the licensees that defend themselves become more active, and that's when we have to rely more on
that is a segue back to Senator Winter's concern, how many of the 169 cases that were received in complaints in 2001-2003 actually resulted in the various kinds of, and that was given by testimony, but I think I would like to see an actual matrix of all of the actions that were taken amongst those 169 folks during the current biennium, and I recognize that's a doubling over during this past decade, a doubling of the overall complaints. And yesterday on the House floor, we heard that as we were hearing a bill of trebling the damages for taking advantage of an elderly person, one of the representatives from the Portland area jumps up and says, "Well, this person would have a great retirement today if it wasn't for his CPA who'd taken advantage of him." I'm not sure how many of your CPAs have been sanctioned with criminal penalties and fines relative to the professional conduct, but that would be something I would like to know, because if we have that kind of thing creeping into the profession, we'd need to know that. Further, I think I probably ought to declare the conflict of interest, which I obviously have here, and that is I hold a CPA certificate or a privilege license is issued by this particular accountancy board, and I believe our LFO staff does as well.
I'm not licensed in the state of Oregon.
Excellent.
Mr. Chair.
I didn't know whether you were remaining in Hawaii or whether you were actually coming to Oregon just in transit. Senator Devlin.
Well, actually, Mr. Chairman, you asked my question in a sense, and I guess just simply in just a different light to some degree is you were asking for basically a breakdown of the complaints, and my question was just more to also why there had been such a substantial increase in the number of complaints, if there's any explanation.
Cheryl will give us that information.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to. And keep in mind that as we're looking at 2002, those complaints have come in and have not yet been fully resolved.
And,
so there's going to be some numbers don't always jive.
Perhaps beginning, ending, cases open, cases resolved, and then the resolution of those cases. I think that's something we are concerned about, Carol.
Mr. Chair, we can provide we have those statistics through 1998, so I can provide that continuum
excellent.
Of years for
Senator
you.
Devlin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is just a short follow-up on not a related issue, but it's one of the problems you have in this building here is as you go through committees and you see things pass through committees and then through one chamber, sometimes you never know if they ever passed through the other chamber, never became law. One of my previous sessions, there were some increases in the educational requirements to sit for the CPA exam. Did those go into effect?
Mr. Chair,
there was a grandfathering portion of that, too, and a phase-in, but...
Mr. Chair, Representative Senator Devlin, that's called the 150-hour requirement, and it went into effect, I think, in January 1, 2000, and it requires that a candidate for the CPA exam, which is ultimately a requirement for the CPA license, certified public accountant license, is that they have 150 hours of higher education, which must include a bachelor's degree plus 30 hours. And the additional 30 hours are not specific, but within the bachelor degree, there must be 24 hours in accounting and auditing standards and 24 hours in other accounting classes. So it upped the requirements of the accounting classes and it upped the overall number of university hours that are required.
Thank you.
Carol, one question I had with regard to the contracting for the testing services that Jim mentioned, as we work through that process, the fees that CPAs or the applicants for the licenses, PAs or CPAs in Oregon, those fees are actually, those haven't changed. Is that correct? Or is there an additional fee that is embedded within the budget that we've got here?
Mr. Chair, the board charges an application fee, and the board will continue to charge an application fee. The amount of that application fee may change, because in prior years, that application fee, of course, has covered expenditures that we will no longer be required to make. If these expenditures are being paid directly by the candidate to different testing services, for example, the computer testing service, and they pay directly to AICPA for the grading service, if those fees are paid directly by the candidates to the testing service, then they're no longer going to be coming out of our budget.
So I didn't see that as a reduction in your budget, reduction package.
We won't do that until we know, we've gone through a session with the exam to see exactly what the numbers and how things fall out. And then, Mr. Chair, we may be reducing fees, or we may leave them level. But one thing is quite certain is they will not need to go up.
Well, I appreciate that because as we move that that testing service out to a contract, then any of the fees which we have previously collected and then dispersed for the paper examinations in the past would then be that would be excess in the budget. But that's continuously appropriated, I guess, or we actually appropriated through the Ways and Means process.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the fees and licenses, the receipts are continuously appropriated to the Board of Accountancy. However, the amount that can be expended is provided through the expenditure limitation
So we will need to follow up on that on the 05-07 session.
Then.
Thank you very much. Carol, do you have a formal presentation that you'd like to?
Mr. Chair, I have written testimony that I provided to you. It's in the landscape version. Can fit in your notebook or not, however you wish. And as we go through it, I'll tell you what page I'm on if you want to follow me. And some of the information Jim has already discussed, so we'll pass on it. But I'm going to start on page 1 of 14. And I'll point out, first of all, talking about initial salary level and our organization chart. Our organization chart is included behind this this group of pages as Exhibit A. And during the 0103 biennium, there were two individuals who were hired at a higher salary level than level one. The reasons for this is that one of these individuals was a state employee with another agency, and DAS rules make certain requirements about the level that state employees are transferred from one agency to another, and it's not at level one. The second individual hired was the investigator. The board expresses a preference to have a CPA as the investigator in order to achieve that level of expertise. It was also necessary to hire that individual.
Ask a question. Mm-hmm. Maybe we need to ask DAS. Is if you go into another agency and you hired in at a higher step, is that because you have a greater responsibility? What's the basis for the rule?
Mr. Chair, state of interest, what happens is if someone is in a salary range 21 and is hired at a salary range 25, and if the person is at the top scale of the 21, the DAS, HRSD rules allow the person to get one step increase.
You didn't answer my question. Is the reason for the one-step increase is because expanded responsibility are merely that they're transferring to another agency?
That's because the person has been promoted.
That's
considered to be promoted.
Let me tell you the nature of this question. Nature of this question was posed to the agency. I posed it to all of the agencies that testify here to the general government, and that is, if we've got a wage that's being advertised at a step whatever, but let's say that the wage is advertised and it's a $3,000 a month position, and then we have an application come in from somebody else that's within the system already, and we say, well, goodness gracious, you're within the system already, and you can walk and chew bubble gum at the same time, so we're going to go ahead and hire you two steps above where at the advertised salary. The concern that I had was that folks that would have applied for the $3,500 a month position did not make application, and they may have been every bit as qualified had they known that the salary, the commencing salary, was going to be $3,500. That was the nature of the question. So what I've asked the boards to do is to come back and tell us, if you have hired at a step higher than what you are advertising, I want to know the reason why. It had better be that they're bringing more qualifications. In this case, you've got somebody that a CPA certificate was advertised that if they had it, they would be paid more, potentially, or that if they brought greater qualifications to the job, then they could be paid at a step higher. So that was the nature of that. Is that correct, Carol?
If I may, sir.
Please.
Advertisements usually are within the whole salary range. The step is not stated in the advertisement. It is between $2,000 and $3,060, if that's the full salary range.
Okay.
And the step that one is hired then is at the discretion of the hiring person. So whoever's answering the ad knows that there's this range, the top and the bottom, and anywhere in between there, depending on their qualifications.
But no one was hired outside the range.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Oh, no.
Senator Devlin?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that there are cases in terms of employees maybe being brought in at, you know, several steps higher than might be justifiable, but I think what you're trying to explain in terms of 21 and 25 is maybe too far apart. I'm not sure that a 21 at the final step will be a lower salary than a 25 at the first step. So that the person actually transferring from one position to another, if they were to come into the first step, would actually be taking a pay cut.
And Senator Devlin, that is correct. And what's happening is the person was hired within the salary range. It's just that it's usually a 5% increase. If someone from salary range 21 is taking a job within the salary range 25 range, the person gets, it's usually a 5% increase.
Okay. Further questions in that regard? Please continue, Carol.
Thank you. No, but I'm going to have some discussion with Dan.
Okay. That's perfectly fine. I'll give you Mr. Rubati's telephone number if you'd like.
I better understand enough what you're doing over
there. If you'd like to put it on the record.
Any help I can do to explain this?
Thank you.
One last comment on salaries. I have also included in Exhibit B, which is a approximation of the salaries for 03-05. The reason I say it's an approximation is because I don't have included in here mass transit. mass transit, and I have included the 0103 costs for workers' comp, insurance, and Employment Relations Board, because I don't know what those costs are going to be in 0305. What I have projected here are the merit increases for each individual, so you've got the salary level, the appropriate increase to the retirement, and the appropriate increase to the Social Security. So those numbers should be fairly accurate. But the numbers on the right-hand side of the column of this exhibit are based on 0103 numbers. And I noticed on our budget, the number that I came up with was $807,000 for the total, and I noticed in our budget the personal services category is $873,000. So I was off about $70,000, but there is our salaries. The next, going on page one, talks about programs and services, and Mr. Gaffney covered those for us, so if you don't mind, we will move to page three and look for a moment at the performance measure overview. The final review by the Board of Progress is, the Progress Board is also attached to this as an exhibit. It is Exhibit C. They had no comments, no suggestions or complaints about the performance measures. Our performance measures relate to three primary goals, and the primary goals for the board are, number one, public protection. Insurance of professional competency, of course, goes to public protection. Secondly, providing excellent customer service. And finally, to regulate in a manner that supports an appropriate business climate.
Representative Johnson's recognized.
Perhaps I'm jumping slightly ahead, but it seems as though the subset of one of these is the number of complaints processed within 6 months. Are you going to touch on why that seems to have dropped so dramatically?
Thank you. I will go back to each of the goals and discuss them. And the first one is public protection, and that one falls in this category, so I can address it right now if you like. We can go to Exhibit C. And, in fact, these figures are not – I have done a revised – this is a revised format that you see in Exhibit C. And if you'll look to performance number three, the percentage of complaints processed within 6 months from receipt – in 1997, it was 37%. 98, it was 32%. We recalculated the 1999 figures. In fact, they were 39%. That would be corrected. 2000, the way the counting was done differently when it was first calculated. We have a large number of actions that are handled administratively. They don't necessarily go through the board. For example, an address change is a simple matter, but we issue a civil penalty, which is a complaint and a notice and a right to administrative hearing if they choose. And those were not added in to this number. Those are processed very quickly. They were not added into the total number, and they should have been. When those were added in, it brings the 2000 figures up to 52%. And in 2001, 50% of the complaints were processed within 6 months.
Please follow up, Representative Johnson.
I'm afraid I'm a little confused. If a CPA changes an address and doesn't notify you, that's subject to a sanction.
Yes, it is.
And those were taken out of the original calculation for the 2,000 numbers because given the continuum of sanctions, they're relatively minor and they're handled very quickly.
Exactly.
But if you go back to calculating them in, then that jumps the 8% up to 52%.
Yes, that's right, Representative Johnson.
Okay. I guess I'm glad for that clarification, but it still strikes me that half is the best number, or 52% rather than what causes the delay?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, the delay has been caused by many factors. Since 1999, we have had a turnover in staff. We've had three investigators. There will be a period of 2 or 3 months when there's no investigator at all handling new complaints coming in. They're being processed. They're being received. Responses are given, but no investigation is taking place. So the fact that there's been some turnover in our staff has caused a delay. There's also been a delay because there has been a backlog of cases since about 1997 that's been working down. We have also had an increase in what we consider to be complex cases that require a more sophisticated investigation and take longer and take greater skills. And those would be the cases that would be left behind as our investigator comes aboard, is coming up to training levels, understanding what they're required to do. It's always those more complicated ones that kind of get put on the back burner.
St. Johnson,
one last follow-up. This is in other funds.
We are.
Budget. And I guess customer service, I mean, I understand why protection of the public is first. I clearly understand why customer service is second. In an ideal world, they'd be one and one. But it seems to me that the universe that you're serving, to be penalized by not having complaints handled more quickly, seems to me to be a huge customer service issue. And were I a CPA whose fees were driving your department, I'm not sure that I would be satisfied by the answer, we've had a lot of turnover, or we've got a backlog, or I guess I'm interested in knowing why the turnover, why the backlog, other than the complexity of the cases, and what specific things you have in mind to remedy what I think are not very good numbers.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I quite agree with you. I think if I were a licensee and I had a complaint logged against me that had a long history of not being investigated, I would also be concerned about that. I think I can only assure you that we don't think these are good numbers either. That's why we've established this performance measure, and that we are right now fully staffed, and we have an investigator that the board is very comfortable with, that I'm very confident with, and who expresses the same sort of goals and ideals that you're expressing and that we are striving to achieve. And I think we're going to show you considerable improvement.
Carol, perhaps the target for 2002 ought to be higher than 27% then?
Yes, the targets will definitely be changed. The target for 2002 will be what we hit in 2002, because there was no target. It hadn't been established yet.
Okay.
And then the going forward targets, those will be changed as well.
Okay. Senator Devlin?
Just a quick question. In terms of when a complaint is lodged and when it comes to some sort of resolution, what is the process? Does the board actually make the decision on the complaint? And if the board makes it, well, then what are the appellate rights to for the person that...
Mr. Chair, if I may?
Yeah.
Senator Devlin? The process itself contains some reasons for backlog as well. A complaint is received, we immediately send an acknowledgement of the complaint and a request of the licensee to provide us with a response. Then it goes into our investigation tally, so to speak, and waits its turn, unless it's something that we consider to be of great risk to the public, and we would jump it ahead the line. Once the investigator has completed an investigation, she makes a report with recommendations for an appropriate sanction based on our historical experience, based on the violation, whatever the circumstances are. The complaint then, or the investigation, is referred to a complaints committee. This is a volunteer committee. It's a standing committee. They also meet 6 times a year, and they are licensees. They are licensed certified public accountants and public accountants. And they review the investigation, they review the facts, and they discuss whether or not they think the investigator's recommendation is appropriate, and they make a recommendation to the board. At the next board meeting, which is usually within a month of the committee meeting, the board then reviews it. They review the investigator's recommendation, they review the committee's recommendation, and the board then makes a final determination as to what action will or will not be taken. Assuming that a case goes to administrative hearing and the individual loses at administrative hearing and still feels that he was unjustly treated, that individual has the right to file an appeal in the civil courts, and it goes directly to the circuit court on appeal.
So, and then Senator Winters?
I guess for me, and I just am pretty basic, and I think statistics and percentages are fine, but percentages really don't tell me how many complaints you are receiving, unless the numbers are someplace.
The numbers are on page 7. And the numbers are up significantly. They've gone from 85 in 1995-97 up to 169 in 01-03.
And Mr. Chair, if I may,
Yeah, on page 7 of the handout.
If I may, Mr. Chair, that is also because we include the address changes now in our total numbers. They are complaints that we work on that take our staff time. They require a report.
Okay.
They require disciplinary action.
So address changes.
They were not included in the prior statistics
okay.
in prior years.
Okay.
That's part of the reason the complaint numbers are up.
Okay. So it would be helpful for me to know, generally, what are the types of complaints that you're receiving? You know, if they're just kind of the routine, or there's really complaints that you really need to investigate, really, what's the universe? And okay. just to say that...
Uh-huh. Yeah, and we did ask for that, and they're going to give us a breakdown of the of both the types of complaints and the disposition of those complaints. Now, some of the complaints that I'm aware of include record retention. Is that still highest on the list, or one of the highest on the list?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it does come up frequently.
That's when an accountant has not returned records back to a client. That shows as a complaint. And that's one of the highest in the complaint categories. I'm going to guess of a 169. You're going to have a number of the smaller violations, including failure to notify the board within a certain number of days of an address change, but probably by preponderance and percentage, the largest percentage would be somebody just didn't think they got all the records back, and they complained to the Board of Accountancy, and it's a major violation. Yes, Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry.
Follow up.
Then would that require all these steps? I mean, I looked at these steps, and you got from acknowledgement, which you need to do, to investigation, to report recommendation, to complaint committee, to that committee recommends, to that committee board review, to that one. I'm just looking at the number of steps that are involved, and if I take the steps and I take when they meet, so then I take how long it takes them to get something through the mm-hmm. system, and so... That's the genesis of why I'm asking this question.
And we really need to have, when we get that case information broken down, probably ought to be in the form of a matrix at that point, as not just the types of cases, but then what the resolution is of each of the types of cases, and how long it's going to take to go through the step process. Because, again, the failure to notify of an address change shouldn't take 6 months to come back and say you did or didn't. I mean, it's on its face, so... But that's information which the board will provide. Senator Devlin.
I think that my question's along the same, actually. Senator Winters and I are thinking alike here in terms of...
That's scary. That's great.
My additional question beyond that is that in looking at all these steps, it's obvious that if you had to go through this whole process, that many of your cases would be going well over 6 months, actually, in terms of, I assume you give 30 days to a CPA to respond or some reasonable period
unless
of time.
Unless it's tax season, and then they get 6 years.
It's wonderful to have an understanding committee.
But the other thing is probably in your response that I'd like to have is when do you have the discretion at which levels in terms of administratively to dismiss a complaint, or can an investigator basically say that there's no basis for this and simply report that to the complaints board, or whether you have to follow through every single step on anything that's like beyond an address change.
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I think when you see the numbers, you'll be pleased with the way it would be logical what you'll see in terms of how these fall off. The goal is to have quick resolution, and oftentimes, for example, when the licensee is contacted by the board that there's been a complaint filed, their attitude is to get it resolved as quickly as possible, and that's, we don't want to take it through the whole process. Our goal is to have them be resolved, and I think you'll see that when you get the numbers.
Senator Winters?
Is the amount of sanctioning in here someplace?
No. No, Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, it is not. I can tell you what our sanctions are, however.
What are you saying?
The board is authorized to assess a civil penalty of $5,000 mm-hmm. for every violation. That's the maximum civil penalty. Mm-hmm. We, of course, can do revocation, denial, suspension.
I would like to know how many sanctions that you have had, you know, how many suspensions you've done. You know, that's the kind of information I would like to know in when you get back to us.
And Senator, I will be happy to do that. In fact, I had begun to prepare a spreadsheet of just that information for you, and I didn't have all the statistics ready for some of the past years so that I could present it to you today. So I'll be glad to complete that and bring it back to the committee.
Okay. And you'll get that information then to us, Carol.
I surely will.
It represents right now about 2% of the total resources that come in. And it's kind of used as the big hammer. So my recollection is in the 2001 session, we added significantly to that. It went from $1,000 to $5,000.
1999. So that became effective January 1, 2000. You're correct about the year. The effective date was 2000.
Thank you very much. Please continue on, Carol.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm still on page 3.
Okay. You're going to have to really measures. You're really have to be speeding it up now.
Well, I'm anytime that you've heard enough or it seems repetitive, please say so.
You just move into Reader's Digest mode.
All right. On our goals, the public protection, we also are tracking the number of website hits that are directed to consumer pages. We believe that this is an important aspect of public protection by allowing public awareness. In 2002, our statistics show that 34% actually were directed to our consumer pages, and that's over a 25% target that we had set for 2002.
Carol, how often do you review these goals?
That's a new goal. Many of these goals are fairly new.
And how about the performance measurements?
Our performance measures, most of that information is collected on a monthly basis, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. That's fine. Please.
Okay. Let's go on to customer service. This is another recently implemented performance measure, and it is the number of customers who interact with the board over the previous 2 years that rate us good or excellent. We are going to measure this by sending a form out in our renewal forms and requesting the licensees to return it with the questions answered, and then we will collect that information. Finally, the goal to support our licensees in a manner that supports a positive business climate, that we believe is encouraged by our annual review of our administrative rules, which is often done in coordination or cooperation with members of the professional associations and certainly of the public if they choose.
Those licensees who are going to rate you good or excellent, that's on an anonymous basis, is that right?
It is.
Okay.
Yes.
Senator Representative Johnson?
Thank you. In your business climate review of the administrative rules, did the board give any thought to including any statutory direction the legislature had given you as part of that review as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, in addition, I'm not familiar with the run of statutes that might govern any of your activities beyond administrative rules. Do you look at statutes as well?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, certainly. And after a legislative session, we always have a full implementation of administrative rules to meet this new statutory requirements.
Okay.
Is that not responsive?
Yeah, it is. Thank you.
All right. Okay. On that same page, we talk about factors affecting services, and one of them is board response time, and this goes back to our prior conversation. Much of our response time is dependent upon getting complete information from the applicants. If they don't return to us a complete application, it can't be processed quickly. If we don't receive a complete examination application with all the additions that are necessary, it cannot be responded to quickly. However, for example, a CPA exam application that comes in with all the information that is necessary is reviewed and accepted within a week. An application for a license that comes in with all of the information correctly placed on it and with the appropriate fee will be responded to and received and accepted within a week.
Carol, revocation of license is one of the greater sanctions that can be imposed. I think there was under 10 revocations, is that right? 9, as I recall?
Nine. Mm-hmm.
9 revocations. 9 as a percentage of the total number of licenses that you issue in the state of Oregon is a very small percentage, extremely small percentage. Do we know what that looks like state by state by any chance? Is that information shared nationally?
No, Mr. Chair, it's not. And the standards for the discipline may be different from state to state as well.
Mm-hmm.
May I also explain that while there are 9 revocations, that was the final order, and that revocation may have then been turned into a suspension with a probationary period, but the revocation is implemented if the suspension is violated in any way. So I count it in our statistics as a revocation, because that is the order that was issued.
I still receive the California information on a monthly basis, and that looks like a handbook many times as to the sanctions that they're taking against their accountants. It'd be interesting percentage-wise to know what those did in fact look like, but I'm not going to ask for that, but I just would make you aware that would be of something that would make sure that Oregon, recognizing we'd have different statutes, recognizing we have different methods of implementing the sanctions themselves, but I would like to have some degree of assurance, because we come back to the mission statement. The mission statement is to make certain that we're absolutely maintaining the high standard regulating the industry for the performance so as to protect the public, and if in fact other states feel like that they're protecting the public as well, I'm going to guess they do. I'd like to know that they're, you know, not taking more aggressive or less aggressive action in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, the sort of information you're discussing is a sort that might be collected by the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy, which is a professional organization of which we are a member, and they are frequently asking us in what ways they can be of service in gathering information or providing data to us. And so that is certainly an area that we can make a request and see how much they can gather. Some states, you know, may or may not be willing to provide it, but I'm sure that if we ask them, they may be able to do something, and we could come up with some information for you.
In that regard, Carol, I noticed that you're from 99 forward, we were expending under $7,000 in dues and subscriptions that we had estimated this year that it would go as high as 12,000, but I think it's a little over 10.
Mm.
Are we members of more organizations than we ought to be members of?
No, Mr. Chair. Unfortunately, the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy, which is our most important national organization, has doubled its dues. They went from, use $2,500 a year to $5,200 a year. So, for example, in the 01-03 biennium, we had budgeted $5,200 for 2 years. And, in fact, come 01, they charged us the $5,200 and were ready to charge us the additional $5,200. Well, they lost Oregon.
They lost Oregon.
We made several letters to them asking them to review this, complaining that it had not been properly noticed to the states, that we had not had the opportunity to present a proper defense, that it was coming within the middle of a budgetary period. We hadn't budgeted for that amount of money. And ultimately, we were terribly sorry, but we would have to drop our membership for the year 02 because we did not have budgeted the funds for that particular subscription. And they wrote back and said that the membership fee would be waived for the Board of Accountancy for Oregon for the year 2002. So they maintained our membership, and we paid what we had budgeted, $5,200 for 2 years, which should have been $10,400 or something for 2 years. So going forward, it will be $5,200 a year for the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy. But the board feels like that's a membership that's very important.
Did any other state drop?
No, there were not. We were surprised, Mr. Chair, that there were not others. There were 3 or 4 who did some talk, you know, in the back room, some complaining and some grumbling. So far as I know, we are the only state who even wrote letters of dismay and disagreement.
Okay. Best you can do.
Yeah.
Please proceed.
Thank you.
We're now down to about 20 minutes total. So.
All right. Well, let's get on quickly here. Complaints are acknowledged within 48 hours. When a complaint comes in, it's acknowledged, and a letter goes out to the complainant and to the licensee within 48 hours. The licensee, as you mentioned, Mr. Chair, has 21 days to respond. If they don't respond, it's another violation. Let's just go on to information technology capacity. We don't have the capacity that we would like to have to provide the services that we would like to provide. For example, we don't have a T1 line connection to our office space. We're on a 56, whatever that is. Anyway, it's a small bandwidth. We would like to be able to provide our board meetings over the Internet so that people could tune in from a distance and see what was going on in the board meeting. We cannot do that at this time without a T1 line. It's just not large enough capacity to send the signals that we need. So that's something that we have set for a goal in the future and will be mentioned in our goals. The board would also like to be to start providing online licensing services. We have a lot of services available to our customers online, but licensing itself is not one of them. And the two items that hold us back are the ability to accept money online, either by credit card, and the signature. And the state of Oregon has had an e-government committee that's been working on solving those problems statewide, and the board decided it was best to sit back and wait until the state resolved them, and then we would tie into whatever the state had come up with. So that's been on a hold situation until it's resolved.
And Dallas Wine is on top of that committee that's handling that, addressing that issue.
Great. We're looking forward to that. I think that there are many states that are offering this, and they're finding, for example, Maryland reported at the conference in January that 96% of their licensing renewals were made online the first year that it was available. 96%.
Well,
that's a tremendous number. Okay, we unless you have some specific questions, we will kind of just skim over the employee training and staff development. May I say that we accomplish what we think is excellent training on about 1% of our budget, both for board members and for staff members. Coordination, I'm on page 6, coordination and cooperation with other state agencies, and in fact I would also mention other federal agencies. We work, of course, with the Board of Tax Consultants, with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and with the Division of Audits, which have obvious ties to the profession of public accounting. We also work with the Department of Revenue, the Child Support Enforcement Division, and the Oregon Scholarship Commission to suspend any individual who holds a license with us who is in violation of any of their terms. That suspension is then within the individual's power to remove. All they need to do is come in compliance under the child support, under tax enforcement, whatever.
You mean if Louie doesn't pay his child support and he's a licensed CPA, then, well, gosh, I really like that.
And Representative or Senator Johnson, if we can get all licensed all privileged licenses in the state of Oregon to start taking a look at those issues, people would, I think, pay much more attention to their obligations, and that includes the 40,000 contractors through the CCD as well.
Senator? Mr. Chair, was this done as a result of the forthrightness of the Board of Accountancy from their own position, or was this statutory?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, no, we were required by statute.
You were required by statute.
It was probably initiated, I would guess, by the Judiciary Committee or by DOJ as a universal thing, that how do you get these people to comply? Well, you do it.
They had it in from their accountants.
Yeah, right.
Well, I mean, you know, it raises an interesting policy discussion if you're required as the Board of Accountancy. I don't know what other boards, the licensing that have the privilege to have a license, are also required.
I got a bill in the House right now that that moves us a giant step closer to that, and that is the boards need to be able to start communicating one with another, including the Department of Revenue, who has been absolutely penurious with the information that they've had, and I've never understood it, but we're going to get to the bottom of it, and we start off by starting to share information, not only confidential information, just information amongst ourselves, and then as we move closer, then again, it's my desire that all licensing boards, those privileged licensing boards within the state of Oregon, will strive to make sure that those people who obtain and pay for privileged licenses in the state of Oregon are obeying the law. I would hope that contractors would pay the child support, but it starts off by making sure that contractors are at least filing their tax returns. Let's make sure they're in the system. That's what the bill does.
You know, I wouldn't have had to pass that, worked on that legislation to be aggressive about collecting that $1.6 billion that's in the system that we could use.
We still need to be vigilant over the accounts receivable, Representative, as you're well aware, Senator.
So please, Carol.
Mr. Chair, we also coordinate with other, with federal agencies, with the Securities and Exchange Commission, with the Internal Revenue Service, and with the State Office of Justice, the Attorney General's Office for the State of Oregon. Revenue sources, as Mr. Gaffney mentioned, we are another fund agency. Our revenues are totally received through fees. And there are no fee increases proposed for the 03-05 biennium, and Mr. Gaffney has already discussed the bills that do have a fiscal impact. On page 7 is a brief little matrix that shows some of the program growth that we have had by numbers. Exam candidates, for example, have gone from 1,500 to 2,100 in 0103, from 95 to 97.
Carol, how many passed the CPA exam first try?
Oh, first try?
Yep.
About 10%. This is about 10%. So if you've got 400, that's about 40.
Top.
And we average approximately 400 candidates.
I thought it used to be about 2%.
Representative Johnson, that's not a common occurrence.
Wow.
As you know, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you can pass parts, a minimum of 2, and so there's carryover parts, unlike other licensees, as, for example, the bar, where they, it's an all-or-nothing proposition.
What's the net number of passes? The passing that take the exam one time, or that take more than once or one time or more?
Mr. Chair, we haven't cataloged that, and it might be difficult because there are people who take it and take it and take it, and then they just suddenly drop out.
Okay.
And we don't track those people at all.
I thought it was much higher than that. This was something we went through the Construction Contractors Board earlier, that we were concerned the Construction Contractors Board would be too tough. But maybe they're about right. I think we said those that passed the examination on the first try for the Construction Contractors Board was about 50%+, if I recall. Mm-hmm. But with an eventual passage there of 80% or 90%, whereas with the CPA exam, I don't think your eventual passage rate even gets to 50%. And that may have been the percentage that I was thinking of. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many opportunities does an applicant have to take the test? I didn't know. I thought it was like the bar, all or nothing. How often until you finally fill in all the mosaic till you're there?
If I may, Mr. Chair? It depends. If you don't pass, you have to pass 2 sections the first time to do what is called conditioning. If you haven't passed those 2, you can keep on taking the exam and failing forever and ever. There's no limit. Once, however, you condition, you pass 2 sections, then you must pass all sections within 6 exam opportunities. Okay. That would be a 3-year period. Now, all of these kinds of traditional rules will be upside down with the computer exam. And I know you don't want to hear about that now, so I'm not going to go into it. But it's involving a great change in mindset.
Will not be any more conditional passes then?
Oh, no, Mr. Chair. It's going to be very different. You may come in and take the exams for those of you who aren't familiar with the profession, you are also required to take all 4 sections the first time. So you are prepared, and it's a 2-day exam. You are prepared for 4 separate, very difficult exam sections to be taken at a particular date. In the future, with the computer exam, you may choose which section you take and when you take it. You can cherry pick them. You may take one this month, pass it, take one the next month, pass it. It's your choice. And there will be not the conditioning requirements, Mr. Chair, yes, that we've previously described. So we think the pass rate is going to increase significantly.
Representative Johnson?
The obvious question that comes from that is, with the pass rate increasing significantly, and frankly the whole profession under some national scrutiny, is it the belief among professionals that it may be a diminution in standards?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I don't think so. I think that from the folks that I talk to, of course, are regulatory and boards, and that may be a different breed than the people on the street. But from the professional standpoint, too many efforts are being made on a state-by-state basis to review the independent standards, and you'll see that as one of our goals, to make sure that those standards are not diminished by a larger number of candidates or newly licensed.
So the test is just as rigorous. It's just not a test-a-thon, a marathon.
Exactly. Okay. That is exactly the point. It's no longer a marathon, but the subject matter I don't think is any less severe than it has been before.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we're not a pioneer in this computer testing. There have been other licenses that have been doing this for some time, and we were very concerned about that issue as well, but what we understand from the other licenses is that that doesn't happen. It's just more friendly, and it doesn't become the marathon that we often see.
With the concomitant resentment of the folks that lived through that two-day battle, and now you've got somebody sitting at home in their slippers picking what days they're going to take it.
Oh, exactly.
Back in the olden days, Representative Johnson, it was a two-and-a-half-day examination, and it started on Thursday, and you went through Saturday, and
you came in by horse, uphill both ways, right?
Yeah. Wednesday through Friday.
Mr. Chairman.
It was brutal. Senator?
Just a comment from an aside here. The one thing I've always wondered about these is I think it's like I'm not an accountant and I'm not an attorney, but it's like a threshold, to my credit, it's like a threshold in a sense that has always appeared to me, because from the standpoint of being able to pass the exam, of reaching a threshold, but if you took the average attorney back 5 years later to take the bar exam, or the average CPA 5 years later to take the CPA exam after they specialize in some area, I would hate to think what your passage rate would be.
No, I wouldn't have taken it the next year. I wouldn't have passed it the next year. I mean, if it hadn't have been for the review courses that were night, morning, noon, and night in downtown San Francisco, you can take the crash review course, which is still 6 weeks or something like that, or the long term, which is 6 months. But it's brutal. But you're absolutely right. Those of us who've passed some of those professional exams couldn't pass them again.
Don't want to sit for it again.
Yeah, wouldn't want to sit for it again.
Mr. Chairman, you could probably pass it again. You just have to study.
I'd have to study very diligently. It's like my mother-in-law said when she came back to nursing after being out for 20 years. She said the only thing that hadn't changed was the safety pin. That's the way I feel about the accounting profession as I look through the pronouncements and so forth. Carol, we've talked about program growth and you've certainly had some program reductions on 7 there. You want to go on to strategic business plan?
I'd be glad to. And, in fact, we can kind of gloss over that because the goals of the strategic plan are basically a recitation of our mission statement and
okay.
Our long-term goals. But if you'd like to look at the long-term goals, we can look at that closely. Obviously, right now, our primary goal is to convert to the computer exam. We've been working on that now for probably 2 to 3 years. I feel like we have it 25% completed. We need to rewrite administrative rules. We hope in this legislative session to have our bill signed by the governor, and therefore we will have accomplished the statutory authority so that we don't have to play with pass-through funds.
And Senator Devlin, we do have, I have another bill in the House, and I don't know, for some reason, my bills aren't going very far, but I have a bill in the House that addresses the issue that you brought up a little bit ago, and that's the requirements and the additional hours that are now required to be able to sit for the examination, which creates additional reciprocity issues with other states that recognize people within the industry, and so I have a reciprocal bill or reciprocity bill. In order to maintain the integrity of Oregon's reciprocity. Once I think this is an issue within all of our licensing boards, once we start out of step with reciprocity with regard to national examinations, and that's what you've got here, is a national exam, once we move out of reciprocal arrangement with other states, then it starts to set Oregon apart as a state that nobody wants to come and practice in or that nobody would deem it a high enough interest to obtain a license here. So there is a bill to try and do that with regard to the additional hour requirements and additional training that is mandatory for many other states and has been recommended by the AICPA. Representative Johnson.
Two questions about setting up your system. I would assume that security looms large to make sure that no one's able to get the questions ahead of time or get into the system. How often does the exam change?
Mr. Chair? Representative Johnson, the exam is owned by the National Association, the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants. They have owned it and made it available probably for 60 years. And over those years, all of the states have come to accept it as the required examination for the license in every state. It is their responsibility and their strategies and their energies that maintain it as a security, a high security and undisclosed exam. They have a multiple bank of questions or items, they call them, and they are rolled over. They are continued and rolled over, and that will continue with the computerized exam.
But it's safe to assume at this state in the exam, life. The three CPAs in this room have all taken that same exam.
Perhaps with different questions, with a different bank of questions in each. At one exam, you and the person next to you don't have the same exam.
Okay. And then why, if Hawaii has taken Oregon's test, and why is reciprocity an issue?
The reciprocity problem which we have now is as a result of the higher level of licensing requirements that the AICPA is setting up, wanting additional hours. And if Oregon doesn't adopt that additional hours
thank
time
you.
That other states have adopted,
thank you, thank you, I got it now.
Continuing, Mr. Chair, with our long-term goals, if we look at 0307. A primary goal there is to update and revise our licensee database. We are currently in the process of that. I think we are about 50% complete. It is a database that was first developed for us 15 or 16 years ago. It's been wonderful. It's a customized database, but man, it's crashed once or twice. And when it crashes, we lose data, and that's really dangerous for us because it may not be recoverable. So it's time to update it, update the software, and put a new face on it, which will make it also more usable for our staff. So we're very anxious to have that completed. I've already mentioned the online services for licensees. We are developing those that we have the capacity to provide. We are waiting to provide licensing online when we are able to. And finally, kind of a long-term goal way out there to 2009, and that is to develop the capacity to make board meetings available on the Internet for folks to tune in when they may.
Kim Johnson?
You may have said this earlier, and I just didn't hear it. Are you coordinating your technology purchases in any way through DAS or getting any guidance? Because I would assume that being able to do any interactive video conferencing, you're getting into a much more sophisticated area of information technology. How are you doing that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we have a computer consultant who advises us on the needs for those kind of things. In the last biennium, we did upgrade all of our systems from Macintosh to Windows PC, and the reason we did that was to make us more across the board with other agencies, with the business community, and with our customers. We had been working on Macintosh for 16 years prior to that. So when it comes time in 2008 and we're looking at this video conferencing, no doubt we will be seeking the advice and consultation of DAS as well.
Mr. Chair, this goes back to the presentation that I think all of us heard in full Ways and Means about 3 weeks ago, the comments made by Jim Johnson, the former site manager for Intel in Oregon, and talking about the state's ineffectual information technology systems, departments not able to talk to each other, how poorly we do information technology. And I think probably as you go out to purchase additional computer services, everybody that's doing that ought to have at least thumbed through the lessons learned from DMV. And while I know I'm comparing two vastly different scales, the problems that they had in putting in their huge system, I think there were some universal applications that might be instructive in just seeing how far wrong agencies can go when they're relying on independent computer consultants who have no responsibility or motivation to talk to other parts of government and talk both literally and figuratively what the machines can do and the systems do. Versus consulting company A and consulting company B. And listening to Mr. Johnson talk about how poorly we as a state do information technology was really pretty chilling.
And when you consider that accountants, relative to technology, accountants early on adopted some Apple technology, I think, as within the industry. And the fight for years was to finally come to some belief that Windows technology might have some application remotely within the accounting industry. And for years we couldn't get software within the accounting industry that was Windows compatible. And so it's just been the last probably 7 or 8 years that finally the conversion started to happen between the Windows and Macintosh platforms. And the accounting profession was eager to accept it early on, but tough to change once they got there. But I think any of those kinds of decisions by the board are being done with the assistance of the JLCIMT, the Joint Legislative Information Management Technology, and Department of Administrative Services Information Management Resources Division. So that's where we're trying to get most of that to come through. Please,
Chair, I'll proceed to page 9. First, it talks about major program changes, which I think are pretty self-explanatory. If you would like me to skip over those and go directly to cost controls.
Chair, and I apologize. I think the House starts at 10:15 this morning, so and I did commit to my members that I would have them back into their offices so they could hit onto the floor. So please jump across there.
And I just have one question under
Senator Winters, please.
And that
control.
Is looking at bank fees. You started out with outside consulting fees are provided for. And cost control, I mean, bank fees are included in that statement. Do you not work with your banking service fee through the Treasury Department?
Yes.
Is that the consulting fees that you're talking
yes,
about?
It is. I'm sorry if that was not clear.
Okay. So it's not really outside the system?
It's within the system, but it's charged separately.
Okay,
other cost controls, these are addressing specific issues that were requested, and unless there's a question about them, we can move on.
Carol, I see tort reform there, and I'm going to guess that a portion of some of the licensure change, the rather significant licensure change and firm registration difference in names of firms
yes.
may in part be driven by some of the tort reforms. Is that what your experience is?
I think so, yes,
okay,
sir.
All right.
Technical expertise. The board really obtains a great deal of technical expertise through using volunteers both on committees and on special task forces. I, as administrator, will also contact professionals to advise me on issues that I may not be familiar with. So we have a great deal of technical expertise available to us, and it is fortunate to us that our membership is more than willing to help us out and provide this for us as necessary. I go on to administrative costs, and overall administrative costs run under 5% of our overall budget, and the matrix here shows you what the administrative costs have been since 1995-97. They're increasing to about 6% in the current biennium. And the allocation of overhead expenses to administrative costs is listed. Office rent, for example, we allocate 0.046. The same with our total office expense budget line item, our telecommunications. However, we do allocate all of the state government service charges to administration, even though there may be some of that goes to a program area, because there's no way for me to break that out. Information technology, we've talked about this. We have a single system. We have a network for 7 users. With our new system, it's a year old now and 3 months. We're having a good deal of luck. We're very satisfied with it. And our internet technology, as Mr. Gaffney mentioned, as everyone has experienced, the internet has brought us so much in communication. And probably the most important one for us right now is for international exam candidates. There's no other way to communicate with them, because we do not make international telephone calls. We do not send international faxes. We do not send international overnight mail. Those are expenses that are not allocated in our budget. And so the only way that we have for efficient communication with international candidates is by way of the email. And it's wonderful. Of course, it makes information available to our licensees and to the general public. We have been updating our website, the face of our website. We've just completed an update and now understand that the governor has another website changeover that he'd like for us to look at as well. And that affirmative action report, I'm sorry, on the very last page, the Board of Accountancy, of course, complies with the governor's directives for affirmative action. All of our positions are advertised for and selected according to state hiring procedures. Members of the board include 5 male and 2 female, all white. We have invited a African American in the profession to apply for a vacancy on the board over the last year, and at the time that individual felt like there was a conflict within his requirements at work and that he would not be able to, but he expressed an interest perhaps to serve on some of our committees, which are also staffed by volunteer licensees, and perhaps be considered for the board at a later time. So we do seek qualified applicants for all of our positions and try to have diversity both professionally and ethnically in all aspects of the board.
Question, how many minorities or CPAs in the state of Oregon?
We don't have a question. Representative Butler and Senator Winters, we don't have a question on a renewal. We don't know the universe. But I think if you asked Mr. Gaffney, who probably knows a lot of the professionals, and Representative Butler, I think that it's a very small percentage.
Then my next question is, and I know that you're regulatory and looking at complaints, but is there anything that the board is maybe thinking about of working with our institutions of learning and working with our schools, particularly our middle schools and our high schools, to encourage them to go into the field of accountancy? I think that's the only way one changes numbers.
Tremendous outreach, Senator Winters, and let me tell you something about accountants that is absolutely the truth. Absolutely the truth. Have you ever known a farmer who didn't have a farmer for a dad? I found one a couple of years ago. His uncle had left the farm to him, and he'd worked with his uncle. Have you ever known doctors that didn't have medical professionals in their family? Brothers, sisters, nephews, uncles, aunts, children. Doctors typically have doctors for children and have children that specialize in the same area. Attorneys have attorneys as family members. Accountants do not procreate. You will not find accountants who have accountants as children.
Then that says outreach is a good thing.
That outreach is absolutely a good thing because what's happening is the industry. And for some reason, I think it has something to do with tax season.
Mm-hmm. I mean, since you don't have a lot of rabbits, and you know, you can't. You
off the record, I'll tell you. But accountants, it's very, very unusual. And there used to be a firm, a national and international accounting firm, by the name of Ernst & Ernst. And I thought, well, thank heaven, Ernst finally had a kid. Well, it was two brothers. That's what it was, because the Ernst didn't have any children that were accountants. So it's a very unusual profession in that regard. Of my 5 children, I'm married to a CPA. As a matter of fact, very uniquely, she was one of the 2 women that were in the CPA track at the business school where we attended university, and the whole school. I mean, it wasn't, you look around, there weren't very many women involved in the field back just 40 years ago. So, but between 2 CPAs, you'd think that, you know, in that process, they'd have little CPAs. Well, of the 5 children we had, all of them were forced to take an accounting class at some point or another in their university careers, and absolutely every one of them said, even though we might like it, we'll never admit to it because we're afraid it might make us an accountant. So accountants just don't procreate. They don't have new little accountants. They don't.
Well, Mr. Chair, to me, this is serious that you do some outreach.
Absolutely.
I do think that The only way we change the fabric within a professional organizations is to, you know, work with our educational community. And often it is where, and I go back, when I was a child and growing up in Portland, if you don't know that you can aspire to certain careers, you're not going to go seek those careers. And I think it just is something that all the professional organization, when we talk about this affirmative action issue, that unless we're doing our job to really get the information out and to encourage young people to go into these various professions.
And accountants recognized that a number of years ago.
And not the ones with the visors on. I mean, no. I think we can paint the picture a little better than what it used to be painted.
Yeah.
When we talk,
this is
an
accountant that wears a beef hat. How's that? Because
yeah.
He's got a beef. But in all seriousness, there is a tremendous outreach program right now within the schools and within, particularly within the universities, a tremendous outreach to try and retract those that have any business or accounting background or interest to try and move them towards the profession as certified public accountants. Now, remember, the actual profession of certified public accountant is a whole different pay scale, and it's not higher than what industry is. In other words, the opportunity to move to industry at a much more lucrative position normally comes about your first or second year in public accounting, and that's frequently what happens to CPAs, is that they're pulled out back into industry, and that's where the more lucrative positions are normally associated. But we finally came to the conclusion that to get an accountant, what you've got to do is you've got to have somebody that really enjoys numbers. And then number two, you got to drop them on their head a lot as a kid, because that's about the only way that you could ever get the kids to really decide that they were going to go into accountancy, because it has brutalizing hours and deadlines and all of those kinds of things, and the pay really isn't as good as industry typically, normally speaking. So those are some of the issues that we face within the accounting profession, But the outreach, I mean, the accountants years ago, and Jim, you may have some feel on that yourself, but the outreach I thought was extraordinary, and then I've seen what's been happening. That yes, there are, but you've got a profession here where your only increase in actual licensees is only a third, not quite even a third, over a period of the last 10 years. When I've got a doubling of many of the professions. Jim?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, you'd be very impressed with the outreach that's going on. It is going on to the high schools and to the middle schools right now, because all of the indicators are that we have a crisis within our profession for a shortage of talent, and it's because of the dot-coms that attracted, and we have a little bit of a lull right now with the recession, which is helping us get the people we need. But if the economy gets hot again, we're going to be right back in the middle of the problem. And so some of the associations that help our profession are very, very active. Scholarships and the on-campus types of visits to advocate the profession.
And the international firms have fairly healthy stipends and those kinds of things to outreach to the minority communities in the profession. So there is a tremendous attempt, and
I guess I would like to hear next session that the board is coming back and telling me that in the heart of Albina or in the heart of Woodburn or in the heart of the communities that are in the state of Oregon, that certain things have happened within those schools, that, you know, there's been some messages given to whether it's Jefferson High or Grant High and those schools, or whether you're through the job fairs or what have you. I think this is an issue not only within your profession, but if I look at what's happening in other professions, and we talk about that, you know, we don't have enough professionals within those disciplines, and yet we constantly come to this body and talk when we talk affirmative action. And my first thing is that if kids don't know, and they don't know that they have an opportunity, and they don't know that they can, then they're not going to go that pathway. And I think that it just behooves us in our professions to reach out to young people and to say to them, yes, you can, you know, and that there's nothing bad about this profession that we're in, even if I wear a beef hat.
And the children, it's a demonstration that the children are being much better cared for these days, because they're not being dropped on their heads enough.
Thank you very much, Carol. Thank you, Jim. We appreciate it. And we do have a group of students that have come here to participate with us today. And I understand some of those may be from Fraser Valley. All of them are. Well, then as the chair of this committee, I'm going to go ahead and exercise my prerogative to have them stand and introduce themselves, but it doesn't need to be for the record, the names, if you can't catch them, please. So why don't we just go ahead and have you introduce yourselves and tell us what your majors are, and please say accounting somewhere in that process.
My name is Victor Sutherland, and I am in an accounting class right now. Great.
Good.
Major, and I'm playing baseball at college there.
Great. Victor?
I'm Bill Combi. I'm a liberal arts major with a minor in political science and health. And taking a math class right now.
He can see me later, too.
Bill, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Hi, my name is Greg Contreras. Right now my major is general studies, but it's going to be public relations. I'm going to go to Oregon State, and I'm a math tutor at that college.
Hey, great, Greg. Congratulations.
I'm Jason Sherman, and I'm an agriculture education major.
Jason, nice to have you here, Jason.
Thanks. My name is Jojo Piquetino. I'm a
theater major. Yeah. That's not accounting.
I'm Rick Steele. I'm actually the trip advisor and I'm the resident slide coordinator. So I do handle the accounting for the
budget. Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Jacobson, and I'm the activities
coordinator
at Charlie.
Great, wonderful.
My name is Kim Kinney, and I am studying early childhood education, and I do POs. I'm the secretary in their office, so I do handle.
Kim, that's a good accounting background.
Do they know we're hearing the Board of Accountancy?
Yes, this is the Board of Accountancy. These are the people that license this guy right here, as well as me, myself. So, well, thank you very much for coming. Thank you. And with that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 5001. And we will stand at adjourned until Monday morning at 8:30, even time. Thank you.